Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, March 6th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on the first page, our first headline reads, Marion Mayor, Big Things Planned in 2024. State of the City Address highlights Marion's rapid growth, new initiatives, by Marissa Payne. In Marion, Mayor Nick Abuasali's State of the City Address Tuesday, he touted Marion as a rapidly growing city that has elevated the quality of life and earned residents' trust at a time when trust in government is declining. At the Cedar Rapids Radisson Hotel on Collins Road Northeast, Abuasali highlighted the city's 2023 successes and upcoming plans as Iowa's 13th largest city and one of its fastest-growing communities. According to the Linn County Assessor, Marion's expansion of residential, commercial, and industrial development has boosted its total valuation by nearly $2 billion in the last 8 years. In that time, Abuasali said, Marion has put behind us the contentious, divisive politics of the past and unified all corners of our town in speaking a common language of reaching higher and doing better, building an inclusive, progressive community where all voices are heard and where all people belong, are valued, and have opportunities to add value. Marion's most recent community survey conducted in 2023 showed that residents reported that confidence in Marion city government increased by 10% to 71% from 2017 to 2023. In 2023, 593 residents responded. The city has added 1,231 single-family homes, 649 multifamily units, and 176 senior housing units in the last 8 years, Abuasali said. Plus, there are 11 new subdivisions under construction with hundreds of units planned in the Rookwood Estates project from an entity led by Marion-based developer Chad Pelly of 2040 Building Concepts. With projects such as the Uptown Artway, he said Marion is catching the attention of leaders across the state as a model for how cities in Iowa can compete by investing in quality of life and sense of place. The Artway between 10th and 11th Streets and 7th and 8th Avenues transformed an underused alley into a destination for art and spurred private investment in the area. In the last decade, he said the city has spent more than $100 million on capital projects and infrastructure, mostly on transportation projects. The Central Corridor and Tower Terrace Road have seen more than $40 million invested alone. The city is paving its portion of the connection between Albernett Road and C Avenue this year, and is finalizing plans to reroute Albernett Road to take traffic directly to 7th Avenue. That project will be bid in early 2025. On top of that growth, Abuasali teased other projects to come. Abuasali said a team is reviewing several proposals developers submitted to transform the old public library site, but it's hard to miss the excitement over the potential redevelopment of this highly visible block. Abuasali announced the city's new mobile library would soon arrive to take books, technology, and other services directly to underserved areas and senior facilities, ensuring equity and maximizing the public impact of the library. Additionally, Marion this year will roll out an automated curbside collection program for garbage, recycling, and yard waste. Households will select the container size that best suits their needs. The city has ordered a new fleet of vehicles and 19,300 containers, which are slated to arrive by the fall. This summer, the city will complete its new public services maintenance facility, a 144,000 square foot building that includes expanded equipment storage, fleet maintenance, fabrication facilities, and a safe room certified by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. If volunteers eventually approve, Abuasali said the city also is planning for a new aquatic center to replace Marion's aging city pool. The project still is subject to voter approval and construction would remain several years away. Crews will break ground this month on the approximately $7.3 million project to transform City Square with a new central plaza. The city in February kicked off the public portion of the capital campaign to raise $1.3 million, with more than $850,000 already secured. Abuasali said Marion still has a ways to go on fundraising and asked people to consider supporting this transformational project and the impact it will have for generations to come. Also on today's front page, House votes to prohibit ballot drop boxes, trim deadline. Dems, bill would make voting more difficult for many Iowans. By Tom Barton. Iowa House Republicans passed legislation Tuesday that would again constrain the time period and options for early voting in Iowa elections. The House voted 62-35 to pass House File 2610, with all Republicans in support and all Democrats opposed. The bill now heads to the Iowa Senate, which has advanced a companion bill out of committee. The bill makes changes to state elections law that would limit challenges to federal candidates' placement on the ballot, create an earlier deadline for absentee ballots to be received by local elections officials, ban absentee ballot drop boxes, and ban ranked choice voting, among other changes. Democrats vehemently opposed the bill, arguing it would make it harder for certain Iowans to cast a ballot. Republicans said the bill aims to maintain the highest level of election integrity in Iowa. Voter suppression from these bills is a myth, said Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican of Wilton, lead sponsor of the bill. He said several states, including Colorado, New York, Massachusetts, Hawaii, Maryland, and Connecticut, have more restrictive laws. This bill expands voting rights by 5%. It gives Iowans more time to vote, Kaufman said during debate. It ensures that our vote remains the most secure in the country. And thank goodness it prevents activists from deciding who is on the ballot. It prevents activists from subverting the will of the people. Representatives for county auditors, the League of Women Voters, and AARP Iowa opposed the bill, saying it would make it more difficult for older Iowans and people with disabilities to return their ballots. They also said it has become a constant struggle to educate Iowans about new voting rules and deadlines. Lawmakers in recent years have shortened Iowa's early voting period and stripped auditors of much of their discretion in running elections in their counties, including restricting their ability to establish satellite in-person early voting sites and mail out absentee ballot request forms. Representative Adam Zavner, Democrat of Iowa City, and other Democrats said instances of voter fraud in Iowa are exceedingly rare to necessitate such changes to the state's election laws. Under the bill, absentee ballots would have to be received by the county auditor by the close of business on the day before election day to be counted, one day earlier than the current law. Now, ballots received by the time the polls close on election day are eligible to be counted. Auditors would be able to begin mailing out absentee ballots 2 days earlier to compensate for the earlier deadline. That would give Iowa voters an additional day to mail back absentee ballots. In-person early voting still would begin 20 days in advance of an election. The bill also would require absentee voters to include their voter identification number when returning their ballots. Current law requires voters to provide those numbers only when they submit a written request for a ballot. The measure would set new requirements for absentee ballot envelopes, which the Iowa State Association of County Auditors says would require counties to incur significant costs by buying new envelopes. A fiscal note by the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency estimates the cost increase statewide for new envelope printing at $800,000 for presidential election years and $286,000 for midterm election years. Kaufman said absentee ballot drop boxes no longer are needed with the end of the COVID-19 public health emergency. Kaufman said Iowa voters could still deposit ballots in blue drop boxes that are in every city and every county in the state of Iowa, referring to U.S. Postal Service mailboxes. He also asserted having documentable proof that ballot drop boxes were installed in an alley, a Hy-Vee, and outside a courthouse. That is not secure, Kaufman said. Voting rights activists and county election officials, however, note mail delivery may be delayed and take days, whereas a drop box lets voters know for certain their absentee ballots have been received. The bill also would prohibit Iowa-based ballot changes. Candidates for federal offices could be challenged only on U.S. constitutional requirements on age, residency, citizenship, and whether their nominating papers meet all the legal requirements. Iowa City Zavner said such new restrictions on absentee voting could prevent thousands of Iowans from having their ballots counted. He said 13,883 Iowans during the 2022 general election returned their ballots via absentee ballot drop boxes that are secured and monitored around the clock, and 3,000 Iowans returned absentee ballots on Election Day. About 150 ballots that would have been valid under previous Iowa law were not counted due to new restrictions on absentee voting enacted in 2021, he said. Biden easily wins Dems mail-in caucus. About 60% of those requesting caucus cards returned them by Tuesday. By Caleb McCullough. President Joe Biden easily won the first mail-in Iowa Democratic caucus Tuesday, earning a vote of confidence from the state's Democrats, after the National Party booted the state from its coveted first-in-the-nation status. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said Tuesday, as the last votes still were being tabulated at the party headquarters, that this year's all-mail contest was the result of years of work by the state party. "I've been the chair here at the Iowa Democratic Party for a little over a year now, but this process started before I did," she said. "And so this is the final culmination of seeing who the Democrats in Iowa are choosing to be their nominee for president." Biden won 91% of the votes, according to unofficial results announced by the party Tuesday night. Another 4% cast their vote as uncommitted. U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota received 3%, and Marianne Williamson, a self-help author who dropped out of the race but later said she was re-entering, received 2%. With neither long-shot challenger receiving the minimum threshold of 15% of the votes, Biden will be awarded all the state's 46 delegates to the Democratic National Convention. Total, by Tuesday afternoon, 12,193 Iowa Democrats returned presidential preference cards in the state party's first run at the new process. The results from Iowa, one of 16 states and territories to hold a Democratic contest on Super Tuesday, came without the frenzy and media attention that usually accompanies the Iowa caucuses. Instead of voters scrambling into corners and crowded school gyms and complicated caucus math, the vote counting took place in a small room in a nondescript Des Moines office building. The party contracted with a team led by Amber McReynolds, the founding chief executive officer of the National Vote at Home Institute, to oversee the voting and tabulation process. The state party was forced to reinvent its nominating process after the Democratic National Committee removed Iowa from its decades-old position at the front of the presidential primary calendar. After botched results process in the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses, in which Biden eventually was declared to come in fourth, the Democratic National Committee moved to reorder the nominating calendar in an effort to elevate the voices of people of color and encourage primaries over caucuses. The National Party promoted South Carolina to the top spot, awarding the state that gave a kickstart to Biden's 2020 successful campaign. While Iowa Democrats held party organizing caucuses in January, the same day as the Republicans' first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses, the new calendar meant they could not tally votes until after the other early states had voted. Democrats long have had concerns about the accessibility of the Iowa caucuses, which required voters to go to a caucus site for hours on a winter evening. Critics say the caucuses are inaccessible for people who work nights, have disabilities, or leave the state in the winter. In contrast to those in-person caucuses, Hart said this year's contest is the most accessible in the party's history. All registered Democrats in the state had the option to request a presidential preference card. The Iowa Democratic Party received 19,609 caucus card requests, and cards postmarked by Tuesday can be counted if they arrive to the party's headquarters by Friday. The party will certify the official results tally March 16th, Hart said. Universities report low administrative spending. It's all a matter of how you define administrative, Iowa lawmaker critic says. By Vanessa Miller. According to a national assessment of public universities over what increasingly is criticized as administrative bloat, Iowa essentially is tied with Hawaii for spending the least on administrators, according to a new State Board of Regents report. Administrative costs per full-time student across Iowa's three public four-year universities accounted for 5.8% of the total core expenditures in the 2022 budget year, second only to Hawaii's 5.6%, and well below adjacent states like South Dakota at 13%, Minnesota with 12%, and Missouri at 10%. When looking at how much public universities spent on administration per $1 spent on instruction, Iowa reported 12 cents, tying again with Hawaii for the least, according to the staff report presented last week to Regents. I was going to ask if this has been presented to the Iowa lawmakers, Regent Robert Kramer asked after the presentation, learning it hadn't yet, but would be. By the time the Iowa House convened the next day to consider a sweeping bill to restructure the regents, amend their powers, and impose new restrictions across universities they oversee, lawmakers said they had seen the report. I am aware of the presentation that happened yesterday, Representative Taylor Collins, Republican of Minneapolis, said, while managing debate of the House File 2558, before it eventually passed with only Republican support. It's all a matter of how you define administrative. Is there something that you dispute with the information that they presented with regard to administrative definition? Asked House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, Democrat of Windsor Heights. Yes, Collins said, I'm very concerned that there's an administrative problem we have throughout the colleges. The bill, if it becomes law, would require, among other things, that Iowa's public universities adopt policies barring the creation of any new vice president, assistant vice president, or associate vice president posts without regent approval. Representative Sue Cahill, Democrat of Marshalltown, argued against that by pointing to a decrease in the frequency with which the regents meet. How many candidates are we going to lose if suddenly we decide we need a vice CFO for a special project and we know who we'd love to hire but we can't even present them to the board, that new position, for an additional 3 or 4 months, Cahill asked. That will prevent us from finding the best candidates, which is concerning to me. Board lobbyists are registered as undecided on the bill. The board's report, based on national models and information from the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, showed public universities nationally on average spend 23 cents on administration per $1 spent on instruction, nearly twice Iowa's 12 cents. We still stack up very well compared to other regional states, Jason Pontius, Associate Chief Academic Officer for the board, told Regents. He defined core expenses as day-to-day operations and most things, including excluding auxiliary enterprises like the hospital or athletics, for example. A separate report provided to the board last week showed how the percentage of executive, administrative, or managerial staff positions has compared with the total workforce over the last decade across the Regent universities. The percent of the University of Iowa's total workforce was 2.3 in 2013 and 2.1 in 2023. The percent at Iowa State University was 6.4 in 2013 and 4.7 last year, and the percent at the University of Northern Iowa was 5.1 a decade ago, but 6.2 last year. In the House, Collins homed in on another focus of legislative criticism, the region's diversity, equity, and inclusion programming. There has been a lot of talk tonight about bloat, administrative bloat. Evidently, we're doing a great job, Collins said. But I just want to read to you four different FTEs and their salaries that were discussed last year at the Education Appropriations Subcommittee that really started a lot of this conversation and the concerns among many people in this building. At that time, the UI Associate Vice President for DEI was earning $255,000 a year. ISU's Vice President for DEI was earning $247,000. And UNI's Chief Diversity Officer and Director of DEI were earning more than a combined $200,000. That is $750,000 for just four full-time employees, Collins said. It is very frustrating when I have to tell my constituents that that's going on. As I shared in subcommittee and committee, the reason for this proposal is that Americans and ultimately Iowans are losing trust in our higher education system. CR man accused in fatal bar shooting pleads to one charge, by Trish Mahaffey. Jury selection continues today for a Cedar Rapids man accused of fatally shooting a man on St. Patrick's Day last year in a Marion bar. Duval Walker, 30, is charged with first-degree murder and going armed with intent in the shooting of Cameron Barnes, 32, inside Cocktails & Company, 1625 Blairs Ferry Road. Walker pleaded Tuesday to a third charge, being a felon in possession of a firearm, before jury selection began, according to court documents. Testimony could start this afternoon or Thursday. The trial is expected to go into next week. According to a criminal complaint, Walker was captured on surveillance video punching Barnes in the face in the bar on March 17, 2023. A fight followed, and Barnes and Walker were separated by other patrons or staff. Walker then pulled out a handgun and hid it behind his leg while he charged at Barnes, who he shot once, the complaint stated. Bill requiring supermajority for tax increases advances, by Tom Barton. Raising state income taxes in Iowa would become much more difficult under legislation advanced by Republican lawmakers. Iowa Senate and House subcommittees on Tuesday advanced companion bills calling for a constitutional amendment that would require a two-thirds vote of the Iowa legislature to increase individual or corporate income taxes and to require that any individual income tax rate increase be set at a single rate for all individuals, regardless of income. Senate Study Bill 3142 and its companion, House Study Bill 721, would enshrine a flat individual state income tax rate into the state's constitution by barring future legislatures from reverting back to a progressive income tax with multiple brackets. What this does is decouple future tax increases from partisan votes, said Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican of Wilton, chair of the House Tax Policy Ways and Means Committee. The constitutional amendment would need to pass two consecutive two-year general assemblies of the Iowa legislature before being put to Iowa voters for approval on the next statewide general election ballot. The earliest it could be on the ballot would be November 2026 and would need a simple majority to be enacted. Supporters, including tax policy groups, the Iowa Association of Business and Industry and Iowa Bankers Association, said the bill would provide predictability and stability in the tax code, making Iowa more attractive for investment and growth. Critics argued the bill would make it harder in the future should the need arise to raise taxes, to weather financial storms or economic crisis, and ensure the state is generating sufficient revenue to provide essential services like education and health care. Mike Owen, Deputy Director of Progressive Advocacy Group Common Good Iowa, said the bill betrays Democratic principles by making one no vote worth two yes votes. Raising taxes in Iowa is difficult even as it is with a simple majority, Owen told lawmakers. The House and Senate legislation enables a one-third minority in either chamber to block any increase in income or corporate income tax rates. That would take only 17 members of the Senate or 34 members of the House to stop majorities from passing a future rate increase. The restriction does not apply to increases in the sales tax or other fees and fines that tend to be borne more heavily as a share of income by lower and middle-income Iowans. Owen and representatives for Interfaith Alliance of Iowa and Iowa's Catholic bishops said the legislation cements inequities into Iowa taxes by allowing only a flat-rate income tax that disproportionately benefits wealthier Iowans. The eventual consequences will be cuts to services that make Iowa a good place to live, work, and raise a family, including funding for schools, health care, public safety, child care, and environmental protection, according to Common Good Iowa. This is an incredible burden, especially if you have a situation where, as we believe 10 years from now, we're going to get a fiscal crisis, Owen told lawmakers. And we're going to be cutting services heavily, or that's what we're going to have to do because of the tax cuts passed. People might not like that, and the person sitting in your seats will then be in a position where they can't correct it. Jack Heifel with Iowans for Tax Relief cited polling from the Tax Policy Group that found 68% of respondents, including Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, would support an amendment requiring a supermajority of the Iowa legislature to raise taxes, whereas 48% would support a constitutional amendment to implement a uniform income tax rate for all individuals. The bills now head to the Ways and Means Committee in the House and Senate for consideration. Republican lawmakers also are pursuing separate measures that would cut Iowa's income tax rates faster than currently planned and put Iowa on a path to eliminate the individual income tax entirely. Ex-U.S. Ag Secretary to keynote CR event, Purdue now Chancellor of Georgia University System. The importance of agribusiness in Iowa will take center stage at the 36th Annual Celebration of Agriculture later this month, with Sonny Perdue, the former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, as the keynote speaker. The event will be the evening of March 21st at the Doubletree by Hilton Cedar Rapids Convention Complex, following National Ag Day on March 19th. A crowd of 650 is expected, with ticket sales closing Friday, March 8th. Tickets are $50. Purdue was the 31st Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture from 2017 to 2021. The department, with 110,000 employees, worked to stabilize the food supply chain during the COVID-19 pandemic and launched the Farmers to Families Food Box program to ensure the most vulnerable Americans were fed. Purdue was the governor of Georgia from 2003 to 2011 and a member of the Georgia Senate from 1991 to 2001. He now is chancellor at the University System of Georgia. Immigration violation would be added to state law under GOP bill. Any migrants found in Iowa after having been previously deported by federal immigration authorities would be guilty of violating a new state law under proposed legislation that Republican lawmakers passed out of the Iowa Senate on Tuesday. The bill states that a person who attempts to enter or is found in Iowa anytime after having been deported or denied admission to the U.S. would be guilty of an aggravated misdemeanor, punishable by up to 2 years in jail and a fine between $855 and $8,540. Under the bill, the penalty increases to a Class D felony if the person's removal from the U.S. was after a conviction related to drugs or against another person, or is believed to be a threat to national security, among other provisions. A Class D felony in Iowa is punishable by up to 5 years in jail and a fine between $750 and $7,500. Senator Jeff Reichman, Republican of Montrose, said the bill is needed because he believes President Joe Biden's administration has not sufficiently enforced federal immigration laws at the U.S.-Mexico border. The bill, Senate File 2340, is similar to a law passed recently in Texas. That law is being challenged as unconstitutional by the Federal Department of Justice. What is unconstitutional is the way that our federal government is abdicating their duties. They refuse to enforce the laws, Reichman asserted during floor debate in the Senate. Senator Janice Weiner, Democrat of Iowa City, expressed concern that the proposal would make it harder for law enforcement officials to work with victims of human trafficking and sexual assault in order to arrest traffickers. Similar concerns have been expressed by charity and religious organizations that house asylum seekers. Reichman said the legislation does not permit arrests at schools, churches, or healthcare facilities. However, The bill exempts only those physical locations. Victims of assault or trafficking could be arrested elsewhere. With its passage out of the Senate on a party-line vote, all Republicans voted for and all Democrats against, Senate File 2340 now is eligible for consideration in the House, which has an identical bill that has not yet been considered in that chamber. House bill requires radon mitigation. New single-family and two-family houses would need to include radon control methods under a bill House lawmakers passed Tuesday. Radon is a colorless and odorless gas that comes from the breakdown of radioactive materials in soil and rocks. The gas is harmful at high indoor concentrations and can lead to cancer. Every county in Iowa is rated as a radon zone 1 by the EPA, which puts them at the highest potential for indoor radiation levels. The bill would add a requirement to the state building code that new construction include passive methods for radon mitigation. Lawmakers said they hoped the bill would help address Iowa's high cancer rate compared to other Midwestern states. The bill, House File 2491, passed the House 96-1. It is now eligible for consideration in the Senate. Bill would regulate drug paraphernalia. Lawmakers passed a bill to regulate and impose higher taxes on paraphernalia for the use of marijuana and other drugs. The bill, Senate File 345, targets glass and metal pipes and bongs that are sold as tobacco products but often used to smoke marijuana. The bill requires retailers to obtain a license to sell the products, giving cities and counties the authority to approve permits. Retailers would need to pay a $1,500 permit fee annually to sell the devices. The bill would impose a 40% excise tax on top of the regular sales tax on the sale of glass and metal pipes. Money collected from both the permit fees and excise taxes would go to fund specialty courts to address substance abuse disorder and mental health issues as an alternative to a traditional court proceeding. The bill passed the House 90-7. The bill passed in the Senate last year, and it now is eligible to be signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. Matthew 25 selling affordable single-family homes in Cedar Rapids. Homes on the West Side, part of efforts to grow strong neighborhoods. By Marissa Payne. Local nonprofit Matthew 25 is selling two affordable single-family homes on the west side of Cedar Rapids on lots that sat vacant since the 2008 flood. As part of the organization's efforts to build healthy neighborhoods, Matthew 25 is selling the homes at a reduced price while cities nationwide grapple with a shortage of affordable housing. One home is located at 806 Fifth Avenue Southwest near the Cedar River Academy at Taylor Elementary. The second home is at 515 Ninth Street Northwest, located near the Cultivate Hope corner store. Clint Tweetball, founder and executive director of Matthew 25, said the home, located near Taylor, is a nice place to entertain and raise a family, near a school that the nonprofit works with to grow fresh produce. We've really invested in the health of this community, and so we wanted to make sure that there are healthy homes along with good schools and walkable neighborhoods, Tweetball said. Coralville-based developer Watts Group is the builder for both homes. Tweetball said Watts Group worked with subcontractors to reduce rates, who all agreed to do so to support Matthew 25. That, along with grant funding, helped Matthew 25 lower the home selling price from the building costs of $286,000 to $224,500. The goal was to build homes that are very contemporary looking and feeling and high quality while remaining affordable, Tweetball said. The newly built homes offer features that are rare in affordable housing, including quartz countertops, soft close hinges on cabinets, contemporary lighting, and high-efficiency furnaces. The three-bedroom, two-bathroom homes also offer a large front porch, finished basement with spacious living room, open concept with an island, and many windows to allow natural light and Energy Star appliances. There is a parking pad instead of a garage. Eligible home buyers must make 80% or less than area median income and plan to live in the home, Tweetball said. The affordability will be guaranteed through deed restrictions for 10 to 15 years and through income verifications. Lenders also are offering other opportunities to lower the cost of the home by up to $58,000 through subsidies and grants. Information on specific subsidies is available through the Neighborhood Finance Corp. To learn more about how to purchase one of the Matthew 25 homes, visit matthew25.org. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, March 6, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. George E. Hahn, age 90, of Vinton, died Monday, March 4th at Virginia Gay Nursing and Rehab in Vinton. Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 9th at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Vinton, with Father Jim Brokman as celebrant. Burial will follow at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. A visitation will be held from 9 until 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 9th at St. Mary's Catholic Church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Mary's Catholic Church. Online condolences may be left at phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Ann Phillips Christensen of Iowa City, 10/5/1936 to 3/3/2024. Although it is unusual to have an obituary in the first person, this is my last chance to encourage others to live meaningful lives. Here goes, in my own words. Making a difference in life is mostly a matter of just showing up. I first showed up in Alice, Texas, October 5, 1936. I grew up in Houston, the segregated South. There I observed firsthand appalling inequities. I attended the University of Iowa, my parents' alma mater. While there, I showed up to shake hands with Eleanor Roosevelt. I showed up to help bring folk singer Pete Seeger to town after the university refused to host him. After graduation in 1958, I struck out immediately for Manhattan, lived in Greenwich Village, and worked for Time magazine. I met the most ethical, devoted man I've ever known, John Christensen. Our courtship was by snail mail as I migrated to Australia by ship through the South Seas. After I'd been working in Sydney for 6 months, John persuaded me to return. I took my time to complete my voyage around the world. We married at my parents' home in Houston, started wedded life in Stamford, Connecticut, and soon moved to Rockledge, Florida, where John became director of the county library surrounding Cape Canaveral. 4 years later, his career took us to Minnesota. I worked in public relations and marketing and earned a master's degree in urban and regional studies. Retirement brought a move to the Iowa City area to be closer to our two wonderful kids and their families. In 2012, I helped found 100grannies.org, educating, advocating, and agitating for a livable future. No one of us can solve problems on a global scale, but that shouldn't deter us from trying to make a difference in our own sphere. Just show up. A funeral service will be held on March 10th at 1 p.m. at Trinity Episcopal Church, Iowa City, followed by a celebration of life reception at 2 p.m. Donations in Ann's name may go to 100grannies.org or the Iowa Women's Archives U of I Libraries. Fred Randolph D. of Iowa City. As the sun rose on Monday, March 4th, 2024, Fred Randolph D., M.D., 81, passed away peacefully at UIHC. Fred was born on June 22, 1942, in Waverly, Iowa. He grew up in Waterloo, graduated from West High School, before attending the University of Iowa for undergraduate, B.A., Phi Beta Kappa, 1963, then medical school, M.D., 1967. He met his wife Donna in 1968 during his University of Minnesota residency internship at St. Paul Ramsey Hospital. They were married on January 11, 1969 in Des Moines. From 1972 to 74, Fred served in the U.S. Army stationed at Walter Reed Hospital. Upon discharge with the rank of major, Fred and Donna returned to Iowa City, where they have resided since 1974. Fred was a beloved husband, father, grandfather, role model, and mentor. During his long career as a professor of pathology at the U of I, he served as course director within the medical school, director of the residency program, medical director of the clinical laboratory sciences program, and vice chair for education. He left as his ongoing legacy for future medical students his groundbreaking work in virtual microscopy, the Iowa Virtual Slide Box. This set of slides continues to be distributed to medical colleges worldwide. After nearly 50 years as a revered professor, Fred retired to professor emeritus status. A celebration of Fred's life will be 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday, March 9th at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, with remarks to be made at 12 o'clock. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Iowa Public Radio Classical Music. Online condolences and memories may be shared at lensingfuneral.com. Richard Griffith Falk, 52, of Olwine, formerly of Stanley, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, March 5th, at his home after a courageous battle with illness. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Richard Griffin Falk Family Foundation. Online condolences may be sent to leonard-mullerfh.com. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, March 9th, at First Baptist Church in Olwine, with Pastor Mike Jackson officiating. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, March 8th, at Gellenfeld Buhner Funeral Home in Olwine. Friends may also call 1 hour before the service at the church on Saturday. Interment, Union Cemetery, rural Aurora, Iowa. Elizabeth Betty C. Zeezer, 99, of Independence, passed away peacefully on Saturday, March 2nd, at Buchanan County Health Center in Independence. Betty was born on June 11, 1924, in Coggin, the daughter of Richard and Anna McGuire Shealy. On June 7, 1949, Betty married Clifford Zeezer in Masonville, Iowa, in a double wedding with Don and Doris Shealy Smith. Betty was a member of St. John Catholic Church and St. John Rosary Society for many years. She was a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse prior to her marriage to Clifford. A fun-loving woman, she will be remembered by all those she touched as a warm, gracious, and sincere person with a great love for Cliff, her family, and ice cream. A Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, March 9th at St. John's Catholic Church in Independence, with Reverend David Beckman officiating. Burial will be held at St. John's Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. until 7 p.m. on Friday, March 8th, at the Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence, and from 9 a.m. to services Saturday at St. John's Catholic Church. A rosary will be said at 3:45 p.m., and a parish vigil service will be held at 7 p.m. on Friday at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, please make donation to St. John Catholic Church in Independence. To leave an online condolence, please go to rifefamilycenter.com. Timothy B. Kindig, age 64, of Marion, passed away on Monday, March 4th at his home after a short battle with cancer. Tim was born January 16, 1960, in Cedar Rapids, the son of William and Maxine Kindig. He graduated from high school and worked his whole life, with the last 4 years working as a supervisor for R&D events, whom he considered his second family. Tim loved shooting hoops and fishing with his kids, grilling and being outdoors. He was an amazing dad and grandpa and loved the big family get-togethers. Visitation for Tim will be held Thursday, March 7th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Graveside services will be held on Friday, March 8th at 11 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in the Garden of the Cross. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com. Willa June Oliphant Ritchie, 92, of Lexington Park, Maryland, peacefully joined our Lord and Savior on Saturday, February 24th, surrounded by loved ones at home. A private burial will be held in Downingtown, Pennsylvania, and then a community-wide celebration of life will be held on Saturday, May 11th at Patuxent Presbyterian Church in California, Maryland. Willa was born May 11, 1931, in Anamosa. She was the 10th of 12 children of Cecil Glenn Oliphant and Sarah Lucinda Betzer Oliphant. Willa was a devoted wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. Willa married her first and only love, James Jim D. Ritchie, on July 3, 1954. Willa enjoyed being a homemaker and mother and attending social activities with Jim. After the children had grown, she worked as an executive secretary at Construction Management Associates, keeping all the team on task. At the same time, she also attended the local community college, County College of Morris, and completed her associate degree in business. Later, after Jim retired from AT&T, they moved to Pennsylvania so that Jim could assist his brother with his mechanical engineering skills. There, Willa worked again as an executive secretary with Weston Solutions. In 2009, Willa moved back to Maryland to be with family. Willa always opened her home to friends, family, and anyone who needed refreshment, prayer, and to hear the Word of God. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Redeemer Broadcasting in memory of Willa. David Lewis Kaplan, 67, of Iowa City, died Monday, March 4th at UIHC following a lengthy illness. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 7th at Agudas Akim in Coralville. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Agudas Akim, the free lunch program at Community Crisis Services, or Planned Parenthood. David was born March 11, 1956, in Honolulu, the son of Richard and Ellen Seidman Kaplan. He was a 1974 graduate of West High School, where he played varsity football and was on the track and swimming teams. David received his undergraduate degree and master's degree in limnology and oceanography from the University of Wisconsin. David married Joni Moyer on November 24, 1984, in Iowa City. David was a lifelong entrepreneur. He owned and operated English River Antiques in Kelowna. He enjoyed time spent volunteering at the free lunch program and the senior center. David was a collector of many things, including comic books, a sports enthusiast, and an educator. He was always learning. Online condolences may be left at lensingfuneral.com. Anna Catherine Miller of Williamsburg passed away March 2nd at the University of Iowa Healthcare at the age of 87. Kay was born June 9, 1936, in North Liberty, the daughter of Robert and Julia Krobe Sirhan. She graduated from Oxford High School in 1954. She married Willard Jerry Thurman on July 31, 1956, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Oxford. They had six children. After Jerry died in 1970, Kay and the kids continued farming. On November 26, 1975, Kay married Robert Bob Miller and became a stepmother. In addition to farming, Kay worked for 15 years as a CNA at English Valley Care Center, was a volunteer with both the North English Community Center and Hospice for several years. She was a member of St. Joseph Catholic Church in North English and the Altar and Rosary Society. When they were able, Kay and Bob liked to travel and took several bus trips to Branson, Missouri to take in the shows. Over the years, she enjoyed sewing, gardening, crafting, card club, and spending time with family and friends. In recent years, she did mini jigsaw puzzles and loved to play solitaire and other games on her iPad. A funeral mass will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. on Thursday, March 7th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in North English. Burial will be in the North English Cemetery. Visitation will be on Thursday from 9 a.m. until service time at the church. Memorials may be directed to the family. Powell Funeral Home in North English is caring for Kay and her family. Messages and tributes may be left at powellfuneralhomes.com. Roy Cecil McAllister, age 70, of Palo, passed away on Sunday, March 3rd at his home with his family by his side. Roy was born August 21, 1953 in St. Louis, Missouri, the son of Herschel and Marjorie McLean McAllister. After receiving his GED, he went on to further his education and graduated from the Institute of Electronics Technology in Paducah, Kentucky, with an Associate of Applied Science degree in electronics. In his younger days, he worked at various jobs, including a foundry, as a truck driver, and was a pallet maker. He retired 2 years ago from Collins Aerospace after more than 21 years of service there. On July 10, 1999, Roy married Brenda Welchance in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. Roy enjoyed sprint car racing, watching Arizona Cardinals football, St. Louis Cardinals baseball games, fishing, and camping. Most of all, he loved spending time with his family. Visitation for Roy will be held on Saturday, March 9th from 1 to 3 p.m. at First United Methodist Church of North Liberty, with a celebration of life to follow at 3 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospice or First United Methodist Church of North Liberty. Online condolences are welcome at iowacremation.com. James Jim Gordon Miller, age 92, passed away in the comfort of his home in Cedar Rapids on Saturday, March 2nd, surrounded by his loving family. A funeral will be held at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Marion on Sunday, March 10th at 2 p.m. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service. Jim was born on September 22, 1931, to Paul and Margaret Miller in Waterloo. Jim was the brother of Carol and Richard Butch. Their close-knit, loving family positively impacted Jim his entire life. Jim was a gifted athlete and educator who led by example throughout his life. He attended Waterloo West High School and was respected by his peers, who voted him Athlete of the Year. Jim graduated from Iowa State Teachers College, now the University of Northern Iowa, where he was a varsity football and track team leader. He remained a Hawkeye and Panther fan his entire life. He served in the Army for 2 years and then began his teaching and coaching career in Orange City. Jim's 7 years, 1955 to 61 in Orange City, saw many highlights, beginning with meeting his wife Bonnie in June 1958, sheltering from a thunderstorm next to a pillar outside the University of Colorado Norlin Library. A year later, they were married. Jim received his master's degree from CU, and they were blessed with two sons, Steve and Paul. In the following school year, 1959 to 60, his football team won the state championship, and his track team won the state track meet. Jim received the Siouxland Coach of the Year award for the accomplishment of his football team. He always paid tribute to the exceptional athletes he coached. Jim also coached for 1 year, won all but one game, at Osage, and taught and coached for 5 years at Washington High School in Cedar Rapids. In 1968, he became the director of admissions at Kirkwood Community College. Jim was elected by his peers to be the first president of the Iowa Association for College Admissions Counseling, representing all colleges and universities in Iowa. He was a loyal and respected member of Kirkwood for 26 years. Memorials in Jim's memory may be directed to the National Association for the Mentally Ill, the International Foundation for CDKL5 Research, or St. Mark's Lutheran Church. Mark Marvin Mulbrook, age 64, of Marion, died on Monday, March 4th at his home. Services 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 8th at King of Kings Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids by the Reverend Christopher Navergis. Burial, St. Patrick's Cemetery, Fairfax. Friends may visit with the family on Friday from 9 to 10:15 a.m. at the church. Tea and Funeral Home and Cremation Services are handling the arrangements. Mark was born on April 25, 1959, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Larry and Marilyn Deke Malbrook. He married Diane Malik on June 18, 1994, at St. Joseph Catholic Church, Marion. Mark worked as an electrical engineer at Rockwell Collins. Mark enjoyed spending time on the lake fishing, biking, playing the trumpet, and canoeing in the Boundary Waters. He loved spending time with his family and helping others. Instead of flowers, memorials may be directed to celebrate recovery at King of Kings or King of Kings Lutheran Church. Online condolences can be left at teaandfuneralhome.com. Lois Howard Murray of Quasquetan was born on March 24, 1933 in Colon, Republic of Panama, where she grew up and attended Cristobal School. She was the daughter of Anthony C. Howard and Guadalupe Teresa Arias. Lois met her husband, Robert, in Panama while he was serving in the U.S. Army at Fort Gulick. They were married on November 1, 1952 in the Cristobal Union Church, Panama Canal Zone. They moved to Iowa in 1954 and to Quasquetan in 1961. They enjoyed 51 years of marriage until Robert passed in 2003. Lois was a stay-at-home mom for their two children, Deborah and Peter, until 1970, when she became the secretary for the East Buchanan Elementary School in Quasquetan. She ran the office when the principal was not there, often also functioning as a nurse, counselor, and disciplinarian. Beloved by both students and teachers, she retired in 1995 after 25 years and continued to tutor students as a volunteer. Naturalized in 1975, Lois was very proud to be an American citizen. She was a dedicated volunteer, even in Panama, where she received outstanding recognition for her work in the Volunteer Forces of Panama Area Disaster Control Program. Lois was very active in the Quasquetan community, serving for many years as a Sunday school teacher and treasurer for the Quasquetan Union Church. She assisted in the establishment of the Quasquetan Area Historical Society and Museum, and in 2012 received the Governor's Volunteer Award from Governor Terry Branstad for her outstanding service to the Quasquetan area community. Lois passed Monday morning, February 26th, after a courageous battle with lung cancer while in hospice care in her home in Quasquetan. A funeral service was held on Tuesday, March 5th at Quasquetan Union Church. Burial will be held at Quasquetan Cemetery. Visitation was held on Monday from 5 to 9 p.m., at the Rife Family Center, Funeral Home and Crematory in Winthrop. To leave an online condolence, please go to rifefamilycenter.com under obituaries. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving on to the editorial page, there is one letter to the editor today. It is from Richard Zerbach of North Liberty. The headline reads, "Do you want wisdom or comedy from a president? Do you have a friend who sits quietly and listens while others talk, then makes a comment? Or a friend who always jokes and wants to keep your attention but doesn't let you tell your thoughts? What happens when there is an important decision to be made? Who makes the best decision? Recent findings report the person who sits quietly has the greater ability to gather lots of information and then intellectually process the data to make the best decision. Do you want the funny one to make an important decision for you? Donald Trump can entertain a crowd but gets nothing done. He only lies to get money for fake investments. Meanwhile, quiet listening Joe Biden is not a great entertainer, but intellectually over the years he has collected masses of information. Then he uses it to bring together dissenters and others to pass bills, to deal with opponents who try to cut women's rights, take over the government, cut Social Security, support Vladimir Putin, control all local legislators. Do you want a loudmouth comedian for president, or a person who is in his intellectual prime, using the massive information and wisdom he has gained to guide our country through a growing maze?" That is a letter to the editor in today's Gazette from Richard Zerbach of North Liberty. Here is a guest column by Preston Moore. The headline reads, "Raccoon Bounty Has No Benefit." Representative Dean Fisher's proposed raccoon bounty is not a novel idea, but no matter how you spin it, House File 2481 is a cruel and expensive government takeover of a dying industry. The bill is based on junk science, anecdotes, and failed historic policies. Wildlife bounties have been used throughout the United States many times for multiple species. Iowa has spent millions of dollars on wildlife killing bounties. None of them have successfully minimized conflicts with farmers or others. In 2023, the legislature passed a law that undermined the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and made it easier to kill raccoons and other species indiscriminately without reporting information. Unsurprisingly, it didn't reduce the raccoon population. This year, Fisher suggests the state socialize the fur trapping industry and deputize an army of non-existent fur trappers to eradicate raccoon populations for $5 a tail. Despite all evidence, he insists that his program will work. Less than 7% of Iowans hunt or trap, a figure that has not grown despite attempts to increase participation. Fur trapping and fur farming industries are dying out, with the vast majority of business taking place with Russians and Chinese fur buyers. Fashion designers and corporations have turned their backs on fur because consumers don't want to wear it. The Iowa legislature has passed multiple bills handing out free licenses or not requiring licensure at all, but they've all failed. HF 2481 takes it a step further, allotting taxpayer money to a small group of professional and hobbyist trappers. Thousands of raccoons will be trapped, beaten to death, and skinned for $5 apiece. The state will pay individuals to take part in blood sport. China can't buy our farmland, but Iowans will subsidize selling raccoon skins to that nation? You'd be hard-pressed to find evidence showing bounties work anywhere. In 2019, South Dakota launched a bounty that awarded $10 for each tail of a raccoon, red fox, opossum, badger, or striped skunk. Ignoring strong opposition from wildlife scientists, sportsmen, wildlife advocates, and others, the state distributed 16,000 traps. More than 50,000 of South Dakota's native wild animals were killed that year. In 2024, an agency official admitted there is no data to show that the program has been effective in its objective of increasing pheasant numbers. That agency has stopped counting non-native pheasants to ensure that South Dakota is not unintentionally deterring hunters from coming to our state, based on the media headlines reporting low bird numbers. Officials with wildlife agencies in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Michigan all agree that bounties are prone to corruption, expensive, inefficient, and totally ineffective. Fisher's bill will cost Iowans money and result in an important native wildlife species being violently killed, and has the potential to inflict long-term damage on our state's reputation. I strongly encourage the legislature to abandon this gruesome, unscientific, and ill-advised proposal. Preston Moore is Iowa State Director, State Affairs for the Humane Society of the United States. And we have a few minutes for sports. Here's the news on boys' state basketball. Decorah rolls to school's first state tourney victory. Top-ranked, top-seeded Vikings move on to Thursday semifinals. By Jeff Johnson. It took a long time. Man, did it take a long time. But Decorah has its first boys' state basketball tournament win, a large first by a large margin. The top-ranked and top-seeded Vikings overwhelmed Williamsburg in the second and third quarters and rode to a 66-42 victory in Class 3A quarterfinal at Wells Fargo Arena. Decorah, 23-2, went 0-4 in its three previous trips to Des Moines, losing first-round games in 1972, 1975, and 2022. That never came close to happening this time, as Ben Bachman, who played in that quarterfinal loss 2 years ago, went off for a game-high 29 points. The Vikings play at a 2 p.m. semifinal Thursday against ninth-ranked Davenport Assumption, 17-8. This group of guys, we never really take days off, said Decorah forward Caden Quandall. It just feels awesome to make history at Decorah. These five seniors who were here a couple of years ago had a bad taste in their mouth, not satisfied, said Decorah coach Jonathan Carlson. Obviously didn't make it down here last year, but just a proud group that is hungry, right? It's big to get your first one, but these guys are going to continue to be hungry and humble, and I think that's the biggest thing, not to be satisfied. Eighth-seeded Williamsburg, 16-9, rode Derek Weisskopf to a 14-12 lead after the first quarter. The 6'4 senior is a University of Iowa football signee as a linebacker, but his first love and initial hope as a Division I college athlete was as a basketball player. He scored 11 points in the opening frame, including a hard drive to the bucket down the right side of the lane and put the Raiders on top. But Williamsburg didn't have a second-quarter field goal, scoring only 1 point on Weisskopf's free throw with 1:37 left, allowing Decorah to run its way to a 24-15 edge at halftime. It got way worse in the third quarter when the Vikings outscored their opponent by a 29-5 margin for a 53-20 edge. While Decorah was scoring in transition from beyond the arc on low block turnarounds from 6'10 sophomore Cale LaFrance, son of former MFL Marmac star and NBA player Rafe LaFrance, and just about every way else, Williamsburg couldn't buy a bucket. The Raiders went 14 minutes and 18 seconds between field goals, allowing Decorah to go on a massive 32-1 run. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, March 6, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.